Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Be seated. We're delighted to welcome with us today Appleton North High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming, and your teacher attended the 2006 Teachers Institute. Thank you. That's always been very successful, and we hope you found it to be too. Please be seated. We also have Pius the 11th High School, mock trial team. Would they stand? Good. Thank you very much for coming. And your teacher, Mary Tulski, attended the 2005 Teachers Institute, too. Good to see you, both of you, again. The students are here with our Court with Class program. And the program is sponsored by the State Bar and this court. We invite students from around the state to come and observe an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they come, hear an oral argument, but they have been given the briefs in this case and may have engaged in various activities around the case. And then, after the second oral argument, the students are invited to participate with a justice of the court, and the discussion will be on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the cases. Everybody is invited to join the students in this discussion with the justices. Now, it's easier to understand and listen to an oral argument if you know something about the case. And the marshal, Tina Nodolf, has summaries of the case. So if you would like a summary of the case, would you please raise your hand and she will give you one. All right. I'm sorry.
Right there.
Was there someone? Yes. Thank you.
It's easy.
Let me now introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser, who is from Appleton, will be the justice with whom you will all meet after our second case. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. Out of seven is a good batting average. I will now call the first case, which is 05-AP-2492, Johnny Russ versus Elliot Russ. Arguing on behalf of Johnny Russ is Jeffrey Meyer of Legal Action of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, I'm assisted this morning by Ann Lott of our office. The case is about self-dealing with other people's money. The context of the self-dealing is a durable power of attorney, a joint bank account, and an intergenerational family in the same household. But the case is about self-dealing with other people's money. To be sure, it will be argued this morning that the self-dealing is authorized by the joint account statute or that it was ratified in advance but for some mutual mistake or that the self-dealing ought to have been forgiven for some equitable reason. But it is still self-dealing.
Let me ask you, counsel, I think you set the table probably, I'm sure, appropriately, but there was a total of $45,000 during this period that came into that account. And as I see, you're asking for $34,370.91, which was dispersed from the joint account at various times for the benefit of either Elliot for Doris Russ and for the business. So does that mean that the approximately 3 years that she lived under the power of attorney, that she was expected to live on around $10,600? That would be about, let's see, that would be about $3,500 a year?
Yeah. The actual time that she was in the household, Your Honor, was about 2 years.
Well, it said that what I was going by was...
The duration of the power...
October, 2 years and 8 months. That was what was in the records.
Yes. That is the duration of the power of attorney relationship. That is correct.
But I was raising or asking you that basically you're saying during that time approximately $10,600 was spent on the mother, and the other $34,000 was spent on the Russells and or the business.
And the factual understanding that I'm trying to correct is that the essence of that $10,000 was spent over the 2 years between February of 1999, when the power of attorney document was signed, and March of 2001, when she entered the nursing home.
And I have one other question, which probably is more factual nature, but I noticed that was the guardian here chosen out of a pool like we normally do? Is there any, there's not a relationship? How do you know where the guardian came from?
On behalf of one of Elliot Russ's siblings, we petitioned for the guardianship.
Well, there was a sibling. Okay, I see. All right.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Meyer, I have a question. I'm looking at the stipulations on in Appendix 137 through 139.
Yes.
And the parties didn't address this, but I had a question given the position taken in your brief regarding the money that was dispersed during or after the power of attorney was invoked. Yes. And the money that went into the account after the power of attorney was invoked. But as I understand it, there was an already existing account that had money that was contained within that account. And as I understand the statute, 70503, as I understand the statute, you do not dispute the ability of, under the statute, of any of the joint account holders to utilize that money, correct?
That's correct. It is the signing of the power of attorney document that changed the legal relationship.
All right. So did the parties discuss, because it wasn't addressed in either of the briefs, how much money was already in the account that is not in dispute that would have to be subtracted should your side prevail from the total that is being asked for? Because the stipulation does, the stipulations and the findings don't appear to cover that.
The stipulations were drafted that way for a purpose, because the stipulations addressed only the money coming in during the period of the power of attorney relationship and only the money going out from the power of attorney relationship.
Well, let me ask the question in a different way, because this is the concern that I have with the stipulations. If there was $50,000 in the account predating the power of attorney relationship and $34,000 was spent afterwards, well, the joint account holders would have the ability to spend the $50,000. This case maybe shouldn't be here.
Our position on that hypothetical, Your Honor, would be that the change in the legal relationship that occurs when the agent undertakes the responsibility, the fiduciary responsibilities of a power of attorney agent, applies to all of the principal's property.
What about 70503?
Even as to this hypothetical $50,000 amount, that when the legal relationship changes, if that $50,000 amount, notwithstanding 70503, if that $50,000 amount is traceable to the principal, if it's the principal's money, the newly acquired duty that comes when the agent signs the document, when that legal relationship changes, it changes as to everything in the account as well.
Well, let me ask this, because I understand your argument for money that there may be a question from your perspective that I can see, at least an argument that I can see, that would say, well, look, once you obtain this power of attorney, You may have had a fiduciary duty not to put money into the account. I can see that argument. But the statute, we would have to rewrite 70503 if we were to accept what you just argued here in court. We would have to completely obliterate that statute that says that all of the joint account holders have access to that account.
No, you do not have to rewrite the statute because the statute contemplates facts to the contrary. The statute sets a default, and the default is no duty under any circumstance, no duty except if facts suggest or clear and convincing facts to the contrary. And our position is the only way to resolve the absence of duty, that's clear in the statute, the absence of duty in a joint account with the fiduciary duty that is acquired is to say the fiduciary duty is facts to the contrary. A newly created fiduciary duty is different. It changes the facts. It changes the legal relationships. And one does not have to do violence to the language of the statute. In fact, the bright line rule that we have proposed as to this statute absolutely, neatly, cleanly harmonizes them in a way that is universally applicable. All it does is say, whatever went before, the parties, principal and agent, have entered into a significant change in their legal relationships. Whether they were business partners or neighbors or mother and son, the entering into a power of attorney relationship changes their relationship.
Counselor, in regard to your response to Justice Butler, are you relying on the preface to 70503 that says, unless there is a clear and convincing evidence of a different intent?
Yes. And I think...
And isn't intent a question of fact rather than a question of law?
Yeah, generally, of course, the answer to that is yes.
Right.
There are certainly cases of intent where the facts that are undisputed become a question of law.
Well, isn't that what the trial court was doing during its hearing, is trying to find out what the facts were that underlie this power of attorney so it could interpret 70503?
And it is the vulnerability of putting power of attorney relationships to a case-by-case factual inquiry as to what the parties really meant outside of the document.
Well, I'm not putting the power of attorney's relationship to that. I'm using 70503 because unless you're accurate, there's no way you should even be able to question the money that came out of this. I mean, it says no one shall be subject to question, neither joint tenants. So in order to hop out of 70503, you have to be able to show by clear and convincing evidence there was a different intent.
And the different intent was these two parties changed their relationship in February of 1999.
I understand that, and so did the trial court. But then I get back to the question is, isn't intent, the intent of the parties, a question of fact? And if it is, why shouldn't we just defer to what the trial court found as their intent?
Two reasons.
Okay.
When intent, when the facts are undisputed, and what I contend is the material fact on the different intent is absolutely undisputed. The parties changed their legal relationship in February of 1999. I believe that it's not a factual inquiry for the trial courts to go into on a case-by-case basis. When, it is the establishment of the fiduciary duty that makes this case a case of first impression.
Yeah, well, that's unusual, counsel, that in many other instances, but this here you want a bright line. Nobody should be able to question it. Nobody should be able to look back at what had happened, what was the relationship, what took place. Nobody can use their common sense because you want this bright line. Common sense would tell me that you cannot have a person who is in the household with all of her needs, food, clothing, shelter, etc., medicine, and you're asking that we accept that $4,000 or $5,000 a year is all it took. to raise or provide that person adequate shelter. That's what you're saying, because that's all the money that there was there. And you're saying that the judge, when he interpreted 705.03, should not look at intent. And so you're saying it's easier. Oh, we know it's easier to have a bright line, because once you sign that, but within this family, as I read your brief and I read the brief of opposing counsel, they continued as they had in the past. And you're saying that this bright line took place and therefore we would not look at anything else. Now, is that, and because this is a case of first impression, I know it's very important, but it seems unusual to me that that should be just, that's it. We look at nothing else. No matter what the facts are, no matter whether you use three cases, the Alex Populous case, the Prefke case, and they were all different on their facts, none of them were of the relationship in the family as existed here. This was a father, strike that, this was a mother and her son and her daughter-in-law, who was a registered nurse that had taken care of this person for the preceding 7 or 8 years. And this is the way it was. So you're saying that when they signed that document, and by the way, how was that document signed? I mean, who was there, and why was it signed?
Let me answer the last part first, if sure. I could, and then get to the substance of the legal question. I believe the testimony in the record was that the document was signed in the office of an attorney in Milwaukee, but that the testimony was neither the principal nor the agent had any kind of legal advice in the terms of the consequences of what they were doing. That's what I believe was the trial court testimonial. Now, in your characterization, I hope you will allow me to say that's not precisely what the argument is, because
absolutely,
I am focusing the bright line rule on the fact that that it is about the self-dealing. The stipulated facts are not that no care was provided from child to mother. The stipulated facts are not that there was some value to those that might be recognized in a decedent's estate case at some point. The stipulated facts are we can absolutely, positively demonstrate that out of that account that was her money, it went to his benefit. And in that context, with this power of attorney relationship that is so critical for people who are so vulnerable, if we allow a sort of case-by-case approach to vitiate the fiduciary duty, we have nothing to protect the principals. Not every case is going to involve a period of time in which principal receives something of value.
Mr. Meyer,
yes.
How did the money get into the account? Who put it there?
There were electronic funds transfers of Social Security, a city pension, and I believe a nominal oil royalty.
It's all her money. It's all her money.
That's the agreement.
I understand it's her money, but who set that up? Did she do it, or was it done by Elliot?
I don't think the record addresses it. There's testimony that the account was created shortly at about the time in the early 90s where she moved into Elliot's household. But I don't remember specifics about who.
But the reason I'm asking the question, and it goes as a follow-up to Justice Rogan's asked question, if we're looking at 705.03 and we're looking at evidence of intent, and this went to my earlier question, it may or may not make a difference, at least I posit that question to you, does it make a difference if she is the person who set up the account, she is the person who arranged to have the money go in the account, and she made any decisions about whether or not that account should change, or whether or not that decision was or should have been made by Elliott. You understand my question?
Yes, I do. And my answer to the question is no, it doesn't matter as to what happened at the beginning of the account, what happened in the 60-plus years of her life in her relationship with her son prior to their change in the relationship in February of 1999 when son assumes the fiduciary responsibility that had no longer existed. The document, the fact that this is a durable power of attorney presupposes that the principal perceives that there will be a decline, and a decline in which she will no longer be able to protect her interests as previous. And so, whatever might have been, whatever inferences of intent might be drawn by a course of conduct or the circumstances of the creation of the account, whether it was, whether Elliott was present in the bank when it was signed, whether she brought the bank card to Elliott to sign later, whether Elliott knew anything about it, none of those facts are material because the legal relationships change in February 1999 when the principal perceives that there is a need for a durable power of attorney, which I think suggests realization of an inability to protect herself. It is a recognition that an enormous amount of trust is being entrusted to the agent, and that's why I am, in answer to this question, in answer to Justice Prosser's question, saying a bright line is so critical.
Counselor? You know, I have a durable power of attorney for my husband. He has one for me, and we're both seemingly competent. We also have a joint bank account that we put our salaries into. Sometimes he spends a lot of it. Sometimes I go shopping and I spend a whole lot of it. Do I have a fiduciary relationship not to self-deal out of that account? I have a power of attorney for him. I can use it for anything.
It's complicated significantly by the marital relationship as well, because half of his income is yours and half of your income is his.
The bright line rule you want us to set up doesn't fit all powers of attorney, I don't think. Do you?
No, it doesn't. And I think that in the circumstance that you've posited, I don't see that becoming a dispute. It could, I suppose. And that is the difficulty. I don't know how to unravel that because I have the same relationship, the same power of attorney relationships, and the same joint bank account relationships.
Mr. Meyer, if I can follow up Justice Rogenczak's question, 70503 sub 3 deals with marital relationships. And yet you're asking us to premise the your argument on power of attorney on the preface, and that preface goes to all three, does it not?
It does, but I haven't thought about sub 3, and I haven't thought about sub 2, which is the payable on death subsection of the same account. Clearly, that is the hardest circumstance. But it does not detract from the high potential for abuse, for misuse of a person's money who is not in a position to take care of themselves, who is not in a position to monitor the relationship.
Counsel, we've discussed, there are three certified questions. We've discussed the first certified question with regard, in fact, that's what our discussion is in large part, Ben, whether or not the power of attorney fiduciary duty trumps, is another way of saying it, I guess, the duties and responsibilities and privileges under the joint bank account situation. We haven't yet addressed the second issue dealing with reformation of the power of attorney based on mutual respect, nor the third issue with regard to equitable estoppel. I want to focus on the third issue briefly, equitable estoppel. In your reply brief, you as the other party does too, indicate, of course, there is a presumption in the law that familial care is gratuitous, in some of the cases. But that's a rebuttable presumption. And you advance in your reply brief that the circuit court made no findings with respect to the value of care provided or the amount of money expended for care. Is it your position that even, you know, let's say you're right on the law with regard to issue one and you're right on the law with regard to issue two, that there is the ability to equitably assess the individual situation, starting with the presumption that familial care is gratuitous, but that can't be rebutted? It wasn't rebutted here, based on the record.
The way I think logically, the question should be addressed in these circumstances of familial care, and this might answer Justice Rogensack's question, is really let's hold it to some level of proof that we expect to be convincing that this was in fact paid for the purpose for which it is intended. On the theory that was presented, equitable estoppel, I can't tell you what is the claimed action or inaction of Mrs. Russ that is supposedly intended to have been relied on to Elliot Russ's detriment. Had there been any kind of paper record of the claimed $100 that was paid out for daycare, had there been something approaching a 1099 indicating ongoing business expenses and ordinary routine of the house, then I would say, justice to the $10,000, I cannot prove that there has been self-dealing. My burden is to prove self-dealing. I proved self-dealing out of the account. If there were evidence that, or findings, that specific amounts of money had been paid from some other source, then I think the agent has an argument to say, my fiduciary duty was fulfilled.
Let me interject just so I can understand. Let's say, I know in the findings in paragraph 23, there's mention of a health care provider that has been brought in to assist. Okay. Let's say the record revealed that they paid the health care provider $500 per week. And I'm going to give you two examples. It came out of the bank account that's the subject here. How does that play out in your analysis? And the second question.
Breach of fiduciary duty.
Pardon? No breach of fiduciary duty. So if they would have presented evidence that, look, we expended these monies for a health care provider, then they could have, that would have been okay. What about reimbursement for monies they may have expended? And how does that all add up? Let's say, we never charged, come up with some other example.
Food and board.
We never charged that. Can they be reimbursed out of the joint bank account if they had put evidence in?
I think the answer to that question is yes.
How about cable TV? That's a good one. Cable TV in the bedroom, $49 a month for a special cable TV in the bedroom.
I think the answer to that question is yes.
But they didn't have evidence of that. Huh? Is that your position?
What's the evidence that's convincing that an expense was really made? What's the marginal cost of an additional person in one's household? I don't want to hold family members who are genuinely providing care to a standard of proof of a CPA. But I do expect a fiduciary, particularly one who's in a landlord-tenant business, to pay attention to some level of accounting. Not what we had in this case, which was basically nothing. Absolutely, positively nothing. no routine records of any kind, including this employee who was purportedly there weekly for roughly 20 hours for a two-year period, and not a scrap of paper record for any of this. And that's why I think there are no findings of the amount or the value of the services or anything with respect to what was claimed to be paid out, because the evidence on those questions is, underwhelmingly constructed well after the fact, or reconstructed after the facts, with nothing that is all persuasive to have any confidence in its reliability. And the judge made no findings with respect to those.
Counsel, did the judge make – I was looking. You said that I proved that there was self-dealing. Where are his findings? Maybe I probably missed it. Did he say that this was self-dealing?
That it was the stipulated fact was that the money was for the benefit of Elliot or his wife or Elliot's business. That's the stipulated fact.
There was no claim that that was reimbursement for room, board, or services rendered.
No. I have no claim that it was for any of
them. Therefore, you're assuming that is a direct showing of self-dealing.
Yes.
That's your position.
The amounts were in more detail than the stipulation. They're covered in the checks. It's about $9,000 for mortgage payments. It's $5,000 in property taxes. It's court sheriff's fees related to the landlord-tenant business. It's the $3,300 computer and bracelet.
Let me see if I understand your position. The position is that this joint account did not automatically, on signing the power of attorney, not sure that is your position. It did not automatically become her account alone.
Correct.
But that account had to be used by the fiduciary solely for her.
The fiduciary needs to account for the income during the period of the power of attorney.
So
now, whether it goes through the joint bank account or somewhere else, that doesn't matter.
The joint bank account had to be used for her expenses alone, not for the son's expenses. And so your answers to the question have been, if the money had been used to pay the son for expenses paid for the mother, that would have been okay. But as soon as he got the fiduciary in there, he could not use that money for his own purposes, even though prior to the power of attorney, he could. He could have taken all of that money under the bank account. He might have been accountable to her under some theory, but he could have taken it, right? Before the power of attorney. Could have taken it.
He could have taken, yeah, shared wallet. That's the
case.
Yeah,
he could have taken it. All right. Suppose that the power of attorney was given to John Smith, no relation. Now the son wants to go into the bank account, in this joint bank account. Can he take that money? Use it for his own business, his own mortgage payments, nothing to do with mother.
Yes.
He can do that. So you're relying solely on the...
Because the son has not breached the son's duty.
That's what I was... You're relying solely on the fact that the son here, as with the power of attorney and with the joint tenancy of the bank account, has a fiduciary obligation on the power of attorney that supersedes the joint tenancy, the bank account.
Yes.
And you're doing that because you think that's the clear intent as a matter of law. That's how you get it out of fact. This is a matter of law to you. As a matter of law, the power of attorney is the clear intent. Thou shalt not touch my money for your purposes when the money is in joint tenancy.
It's clear intent, but the legal relationships of the parties has changed. Yes.
Okay. I think you should, when you sit down, look at sub 3 in the marital, because it's a reference to the marital estate. And there they say no one except the husband and wife can challenge the use of that joint account. Then it presides a procedure for the husband and wife to make that challenge. That's a very different provision than on sub 1, where there is no such procedure.
May I ask you, sir, if Mr. Russ had put in $1,000 in that joint account, could he take it out?
Yes, because he's not self-dealing with the principal's money.
So you really are asking for an accounting of every dollar that's taken out of the joint account.
I think that's a core duty of a power of attorney agent, yes. Had there been any suggestion at all that the money that was taken out of the account for Elliot's personal use could in any way be traceable to Elliot, we would have failed in proving self-dealing with the principal's money. But we didn't fail in proving self-dealing with the principal's money. The joint account could still be used. It just says, in fulfillment of the fiduciary duty, you have to show us that you are not self-dealing with the principal's money. That's why I started with saying the case is about self-dealing. That's what makes it different.
What exactly is self-dealing? Could you define that?
It's making an arrangement, some arrangement, in which you profit with the resources of the person with whom you have the fiduciary responsibility.
Well, now, suppose Elliot bought, I'm injecting religion into here, but suppose Elliot bought a Christmas present for a sibling out of that account. That would be perfectly all right, wouldn't it? For his mother.
The facts of this case don't come anywhere close to that sort of line drawing. I can see that a agent could say, the thing that I bought for you, that I gave to you on the occasion of this holiday, is an appropriate use of your money. I wouldn't criticize an agent for saying I bought something that she needed to give to her on her birthday.
Is this, if the son were to go into the count and buy a present for a sibling, I don't know what the sibling is, I don't think that would be a problem. But it seems to me if what you're saying is if the son were to take some of that money and buy a present at holiday time for the daughter or Doris or himself so that his mother could give them a present, that's self-dealing.
No, I don't think that is, because the purpose is I am doing an expense that the principal would make under these circumstances, and that's not self-dealing. Even though you are the person who went out and bought it, you're essentially saying, nephew, here's grandma's present. And I don't think that's self-dealing. I don't.
Well, but you want a nice bright line. And
I want a bright line that makes us prove self-dealing, yes. But once I prove self-dealing, then that's where, and if I came in and was trying to argue that the purchase of a birthday present for a grandchild was self-dealing, I would throw myself out of court. I wouldn't make that argument. But that's not the nature of what we proved.
You want this court to accept, if I understand your argument, you want the court to accept that there has been self-dealing here. because the money was used for business and personal expenses of the power of attorney, and that was not challenged, and that there was no evidence that it was used for a purpose of the mother.
That's correct.
If there was evidence there was no self-dealing, and there were, or there was evidence that it was used for a purpose of the mother, then the rule, flat rule, you
would not
claim
apply.
Does not apply. The flat correct. Rule you want is when there's self-dealing, when there is no evidence that this was used for a purpose that the mother wanted or was part of her traditional, normal activities, then you have to say that the fiduciary did not have the power to do that. You don't want a rule that says instantly when you have a power of attorney and a joint account, the joint account folds and that there's a mother's account only.
You've correctly summarized my argument, yes.
That's what your position is.
Yes.
It is not merely the mother's account, but that the money could not be used for self-dealing. Suppose he gave the money to a brother for the mortgage.
For his mortgage?
For the brother's mortgage. I'm just changing it away from
the
situation that Justice Prosser gave you would be in the normal relationship, assuming that there was an exchange of Christmas gifts ordinarily. Now I'm saying there's no relationship here that the mother has supported another child's mortgage. Now there's a use of the funds. The fiduciary takes it out, puts it in his account, and we can trace this, and now he gives it to brother for mortgage or business.
Right. That wouldn't be a breach of the duty of self-dealing that the
That's
agent
right.
has, but it would be a breach of the agent's duty for using the money for a purpose that is not intended
That's right.
for the principal.
And that would then come up into a different principle that you would say he abused his power as a fiduciary.
Correct. Yes.
So the facts are irrelevant other than to say there is self-dealing and there's no proof that there was money owed and that this was taken out as a reimbursement and then it was his money.
That's correct.
And it only deals if the same person is a joint tenant and has the power of attorney.
That's when the two statutes come into conflict. Yes.
The brother had been a... had the power of attorney, and then Elliot had the joint tenancy, and then took out all the money. You might get the fiduciary as being careless in preserving the property, but it would be a Russ's money, Elliot's money, at least to begin with.
Exactly.
Wouldn't come under your rule.
That's correct. That would not be this case. Our claim would be against the other agent for having. Allowed the principal to be in such a vulnerable position.
We could have another bright line rule, which says the person with the power of attorney has also a joint tenancy. Joint tenancy is perfectly good, stays exactly the way it is.
That's a rule of an immunity, and I think it's a dangerous rule because it turns the joint account into a money laundering machine. It allows an enormous abuse. That is my fear.
Well, that's the suggestion that your opposing counsel has that they use in Illinois. They cite some of the Illinois cases and indicate that that's the approach between the where there is this joint account and there is an attorney, a power of attorney set up. And they suggest that not all cases. And the principle you want is very admirable. I think that's a good principle. This is perhaps a very difficult case that you're bringing up on. This is a case where there seems to have been, if there is self-dealing, and you say that there is, perhaps there are a lot of equities here. And you're saying you can't look at the equities. It doesn't make any difference.
I think the duty of a fiduciary should not be subjected to the sort of vague fairness, equitable argument.
See, this argument. Isn't, well, you, that's interesting. What's vague about this case? And what, when you look at the fairness, certainly you seem to take the position that Judge Noonan should not have done and looked at those things. And that, that he abused his discretion, actually erroneously exercised his discretion here.
I don't think our arguments are that the judge erroneously exercised his discretion. I think the judge applied the wrong standards of law.
Okay.
And my concern is that when you open up durable powers of attorney to the equitable arguments that are made when our contest is between two perfectly competent people in a business relationship, it is a bad legal policy, because the only evidence that I have of intent of a person who is now incompetent and incapable of speaking is the words that were used in the power of attorney document. Lawyers can make all sorts of arguments about intent, and we see it all the time on facts that are presented in front of juries, and there's always disputes as to what inferences should be drawn. But the principal cannot speak. The only voice that I can have on behalf of the principal are the words that were used. We can't get into her mind, and we only have the self-serving testimony of the self-dealer. And as a rule of law, as a matter of policy, that's why I'm advocating for the bright line. It's the only way in this circumstance that the self-dealers are the only game in town.
Thank you, counsel. Despite the fact that your red light has been on for a while, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Buxman, Mr. Barry S. Buxman, representing Elliot Russ.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, first I wanted to possibly address an issue that Judge Justice Rogensack brought up about the fact that there's marital couples out there that have joint accounts and also have durable power of attorneys, and they don't see a dispute coming. Well, the people in this relationship didn't see a dispute coming either. I think one of the judge's major findings was that even Johnny Russ, from all the facts and circumstances of this case, didn't want this case to end up in court. No one in the entire relationship believed or even imagined they would end up in court on this situation. I think the power of attorney was drafted for reasons other than changing any relationship under that had previously existed under the joint account. They think it was done for transactive ease with outside parties due to worsening health of Johnny Russ. But
Mr. Buxman, you don't dispute that something changed when Elliot Russ agreed to accept the power of attorney, do you?
Well, Justice Butler, there was testimony here that there was an argument here that the words of the power of attorney are the only thing it should count. And the power of words in the power, there's an accounting provisions that could be chosen in the power of attorney. And I believe it says periodic or final.
But that's not my question. I'm looking directly at Appendix 135. By accepting or acting under the appointment, the agent assumes the fiduciary and other legal responsibilities and liabilities of an agent. And that is signed by Elliot Russ. Yeah. So I guess my question is, you don't dispute that something has changed, do you?
Well, I believe that something has changed, but I don't believe it's changed with regard to the joint account, because there was no accounting provision in the...
Well, I want to ask you about the joint account, because I'm looking, and I want to go a couple of pages earlier, at Appendix 133, and then I'm going to go back to Appendix 132. At Appendix 133, there's a provision for banking. My agent may conduct business with financial institutions, including endorsing all checks and drafts made payable to my order and collecting the proceeds, signing in my name checks and orders on all accounts in my name or for my benefit, withdrawing funds from my accounts in my name, opening accounts in my name, and entering into and removing articles from my safety deposit box. So there is a provision that allows for banking under the second item that's initialed by Johnny Russ. Then I go back to the beginning of the power of attorney at Appendix 132. By signing this document, and this is for Ms. Russ now, you are not giving up any rights to control your finances and property yourself. And I asked the question now that I attempted to ask Mr. Meyer before. On the one hand, you have an account here, a joint account that everybody agrees under 70503 that before this power of attorney took effect, under the statute, they all had equal access to the account. Correct?
Yes.
Now you have the power of attorney, which on the one hand gives Elliot Russ the opportunity to, or the responsibility to manage her finances and her banking account, while on the other hand, reserving for her the right to control her own finances. You follow where I am right now?
Yes.
All right. So that goes to the question, that's what I tried to ask before. You have money that was already in the account. The account was already set up. Whose responsibility was it, once the fiduciary relationship was established, to determine whether the money should continue to go into the joint account or whether the money should go somewhere else? Was that Johnny Russ's responsibility, Elliot Russ's responsibility? How does that play out?
Well, I may be a little off the subject on this, but I think a simple solution to these cases in the future is that when a power of attorney is established such as this, it's a simple matter for the principal, while she's still competent, to close that joint account. I don't see why that couldn't have been done. I also don't think
she was still competent at the time the power of attorney was set.
Yes. I also don't think that Elliot Russ actually ever used the power of attorney. According to the one Illinois bankruptcy case, if the joint account is set up and the income stream's already going in there, he didn't change anything. It remained the same. So I don't think he breached any duty. I don't think he ever self-dealt, and I don't think he ever used the power of attorney. There's a duty as to dealing with other people, but I don't think it was intended to change the joint account. The joint account has its own intent provisions, and I think that's what the judge was trying to do by bringing in all the other intent evidence, was to determine whether there was a different intent under Section 70503.
Are you asking for a bright line rule, too? Are you asking for a bright line rule, too, that if you got a power of attorney and you're a joint tenant that was set up before the power of attorney, the joint tenant has full access to the account, just as if there was no power of attorney?
Well,
your bright line?
Your Honor, I think it might be better to base it on the facts and circumstances of the case.
Let's just take facts here, if you agree, that there was money in the account was set up before the power of attorney. Set up as a joint tenancy between the mother and the son who had the power of attorney. That money of the mother's, only money of the mother's, is in this account. That the joint tenant used the mother's money that was in the account to pay personal bills of the joint tenant and did not bring in evidence that these were reasonable expenses of his for the care of the mother. That's the facts in this case. Maybe you disagree with that.
Well, it's the facts of this case leaving out other facts, because there's no accounting requested in the power of attorney. And also,
this was a lawsuit by the guardian against the fiduciary for wasting of assets or self-dealing, right?
Yes.
So that's where you got it. And so there was no defense that this was not self-dealing. Was there a defense that he was owed this money by the mother?
Well, the fact is, I don't think there's self-dealing when there's a relationship where there's commingling of money for
Well, that's why I said there wasn't commingling. This was all the mother's money, but under joint tenancy, he had a right to use it. So you want a clear rule that that joint tenancy survives.
Yes.
Maybe not, because there's another rule, and that is it just depends on the intent of the parties, and that your client demonstrated to the trial court that the mother's intent was that he have full access to the money for whatever reasons he wanted.
That's correct.
So that's a middle rule. That's not a clear rule, either A or B. It's saying, look at the intent of the mother in why she used a joint tenancy with only her funds.
Yes.
So which do you prefer, clear or the middle rule?
I really think this case is...
You don't care because you just want to win.
What?
I said you don't care because you just want to win.
No, I do care because there is some problems with protecting the elderly in cases like this. But I think the facts of this case are the wrong case to bring the extension of a bright line rule under.
Which do you prefer? You had a bright line rule and a middle rule in your brief also. Which one are you advancing?
Well, I think
or don't you have any preference? Well, I'm following up with Chief's question. What are you asking this court to do?
I'm asking the court to look at the facts of the case.
So you're going
and not
the middle
exclude
rule.
Them under Prafke, because I think Prafke applies to a power of attorney document that there can't be extrinsic evidence of the right of self-dealing or gratuitous transfers, but I don't think it applies to 70503.
Okay, so you're going for the middle rule? In other words,
every
case you look at the intent of the parties, is that what you're advancing?
Well, I think, you know, I really
aren't
think...
Or aren't you? Let me advance. Just
because,
let me know. Okay.
Because I believe that, aside from judicial economy, and I think that the facts of the case are important, and I think this is a case where the people did not see this coming.
Let me look at the facts of the case. We're dealing with 34,000... How much? That's the subject of this case. $34,379.91, as I understand it.
Yes.
Is that right? Now, I look at the stipulation for the facts on Appendix 138 and 139. And that stipulation with regard to what happened with that money is, as I understand it, that in money was spent for the benefit of Elliot Russ. And then the details of 29 items. It ends up with, let's say, number 29, $1,298.74 to Sam's Club for bracelet. That's that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And 28 is a Discover card for $3,000. 27 is the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department for $1,000. Do you know what that was for, the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department for $1,040?
I think Mr. Russ might run a process service type of business.
But regardless of what they are individually, it's stipulated that all is for the benefit of Elliot Russ. According to the stipulation, I'm going to follow, but that's what the stipulation says.
Yes. Yeah.
So why... Why isn't there evidence in the record about paying for bringing in a health care provider and what that cost? And why is the only evidence in the record regarding this $34,000 a bracelet and process serving for his business? And, you know, why isn't there?
Justice Bradley, I think there is evidence in the record. I think Joyce Jones, I believe her name was Joyce Jones,
yeah.
the private caregiver, testified to the fact that she was paid $100 a week on a year-round basis to give private care. And I think, you know, the stipulation itself, it's hard to deny that checks were made out and who they're made out to. But whether something's for the ultimate benefit of somebody or the just like a temporary benefit, you know, a temporary benefit at Elliot Russ to be able to write a check out of that account at the time to pay this amount because it was convenient, just like it's convenient for Johnny Russ to get food when Elliot Russ buys it at the store and brings it home.
What should we do with this as a court? You say that there is evidence in the record of $100 a week of payment to this Leah Powers.
No, I believe Leah Powers is the daughter. I think it's Joyce Jones.
Okay, Joyce Jones.
Yes,
okay.
Jones.
It says a paid caretaker was present almost daily for many years at the direction of Doris Russ and defendant, in addition to care given by, okay, Doris Russ, Leah Powers. Okay. Now, but we have no finding about any amounts in by the trial court. And nothing in the stipulation. What are we supposed to do if it's in the record but not a finding or not a part of the stipulation? What would you suggest?
I think the judge realized that when a registered nurse who's Doris Russ is giving care on a daily basis for a number of years, and Joyce Jones is coming in, and the cost of room and board and the cost of feeding and vacations and everything amounted to more. It was just a general finding, I believe, that everything amounted to more than what was actually deposited into the account.
One of my
that's why she should, Johnny Rush should be stopped from asserting this claim.
The equitable estoppel, the
yes.
Third question. One of my concerns, now, the students might not realize that and justices have different views on things. I think this is one of the most important cases that we will handle this year. I think this case touches the lives of potentially every family in this state. And it's at a time, which makes this case so important, it's at a time when you have population is aging, so greater need for health care for a greater amount of people at the end of life. It's at a time when the self-help stuff, do your own legal work, and that's, you know, people go to the internet and download this stuff or go to Wisconsin legal forms at some bookstore and pick this up, and they do their own legal work. And so you have greater use, and then it's also at a time when families, the nuclear family is all over, from California to Shanghai, and so you don't have kids, if there are kids, living in the community. So you have to rely on people who may not be your sons and daughters, but might be your niece or your nephew or your neighbor or a friend. So all of this is converging to make this exceedingly important case. My concern is, with the rules of law here, that they have to apply not only, and I'm assuming your clients are ready to be canonized for sainthood, you know, that they were good. I don't know that. You know, every family has their story. I don't know why another sibling wanted a guardian appointed, but I'm going to assume your clients are candidates for sainthood. What do we do with the rule of law in situations where there's less than saintly conduct? Doesn't your argument regarding the rule of law open it up to abuse, to vulnerable people being abused?
Well, I thought another solution to this case is to somehow, it may be a legislative function, but to change the power of attorney document itself and put something in there to the effect that the joint account that now exists, if one exists, is either going to be a convenience account or not a convenience account, or that it should instruct that it should have a warning in there saying that possibly if there's a joint account that exists, please say please be aware that you should possibly close that account and reopen a new account.
And
because to me it's a completely different situation when the joint account is open after the power of attorney.
Well, counsel, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And that's one of the problems, in my mind, with this power of attorney, because it's kind of, it's not filled out maybe the way it would be with advice of counsel, and there's room to give those kinds of instructions, and a lot of stuff is left blank here.
Your clash here is, as I understand it, you're asking this court to look at 70503. Obviously, the opposing counsel says we should look at the durable power of attorney. That should prevail. The difficulty is that in 705, it says you have to look at the intent of the parties, and I think that's what Justice Butler talked about. So it isn't, and this is, I think, a very, very important case. This case affects probably thousands of people in this state alone, if not tens of thousands. This is they come at us different ways. Some of the cases that are used here that are not necessarily on point, but the law to come out of this case, as I gather, you would like us to look at the intent, although that's more difficult. But I think, as Justice Bradley indicated, we have all this self-help going on around the state where people are doing this without advice of counsel. And now counsel, they're not here. Counsel are here, and they want us to apply strictly the black letter, the bright line rules, and say, all right, this is, you have offended the law, that you should not look at intent. What I'm trying to say is, and you were, they kind of begged for the answer here, the middle road, perhaps in some cases you have to look for intent, because if this court were to say that it's always the durable power of attorney, I think it would be difficult to come up with an answer, perhaps in this case. And I wanted to know does the durable power of attorney trump 705, or does 705.03 trump that, or are we to look at everything and try to balance the equities here?
Well, my thought is that a bright line rule either way sacrifices mm-hmm. fairness in an individual case under the facts of the case. Unless it can be put forth in one of these statutes that, or in the power of attorney document itself, that either warnings or some kind of be aware of this, that this could be a conflict.
We can't do that.
Or this case could make people aware of it.
We can't redraft that. We have to take this case as it's being presented by yourself and opposing counsel, Mr. Meyer. We cannot, that's sort of a wish list, but I don't think this court is going to be able to rewrite the durable power of attorney or 705.03. We're going to have to come down, hopefully, with a reasonable answer, but one that's not going to just apply to this case. As Justice Bradley said, this is going to apply to tens of thousands of cases around the state, and it's obvious that the easier rule, we want a rule that people can follow, and certainly the durable power of attorney has, I know that in my mother has the durable power of attorney. I think if you look around the bench here, probably many families use that, and that is, you know, you don't want people to be misusing their power. Here, as you have explained, and I think the judge, Noonan, said, you know, there are a lot of equities. So what do you want us to do here?
Well,
other than you want to prevail, but how do we, as sometimes the chief says, how do we write the case to be impartial and fair and to look at the, as you want us to look at the intent and the equities?
Well, one of the problems, I think, is that I don't think normal people without attorney's advice even understand what all the implications of an agency or fiduciary duty are. And you do have people doing
these
documents.
Well, ignorance of the law is no excuse, so.
Well, that's.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I'm kidding, I'm just saying that that's part of the problem. When you have these self-help or do-it-yourself, here you had a do-it-yourself joint account set up. That says you look at the intent, and that's what they use. Then they went after that, and they sort of, on their own, I think opposing counsel said there isn't any evidence that there was, they did this on their own. Now, he said that they were signed in front of an attorney. I don't know, maybe they did, but I didn't see where legal counsel was in this, but they did it. And that, once he said that happened, the curtain dropped. And from then on, it's an absolute positive act, and you have to count for every dime, and there is no self-dealing.
That's where the how you use the joint account before the power of attorney and how you use it afterwards comes into play, because there was absolutely no change before and after, and the intent of the parties is pretty obvious that there was no change.
Mr. Buxman, can I ask you a question that I've heard from several people here now? What are you really proposing? And as I read your brief, and tell me if I'm wrong, as I read your brief, it seemed to me that you liked the Illinois approach, that you liked the idea of the competing presumptions, and that you liked looking at what the situation was that was in existence at the time that the durable power of attorney was executed. Am I wrong in that regard?
Well, I think there could be a bright-line rule in this case based on the fact that I don't think Elliot Russ ever used the power of attorney under Marcet, under In re Marcet, which I also cite as the most recent Illinois case.
I'm asking you much more directly. Are you asking us to follow the Illinois approach as I understand it from your brief, or do you have a different approach that you're asking us to adopt?
Well, I'm not asking specifically for the Illinois approach. I mean, they get into these things like convenience accounts, and they get into conflicting presumptions, but I think it's an issue of what's the intent under 70503 when the power of attorney conflicts with the joint account statute, and therefore I think maybe there has to be determination of whether there was an intent for the joint account to remain the same, the usage of the joint account to remain the same before and after the power of attorney. If there can't be a bright line rule that
I'm
it was
just
never
thinking. Well, it said yes, that it was the same. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just thinking about if we take the approach that I think you're advocating, the approach taken here by Judge Noonan, it seems to me that we're opening up the door to an enormous number of trials. If the judge always has to look at, for instance, should I reform the durable power of attorney? What are the equities here? Should I apply equitable estoppel? It seems to me there's going to be no end of trials. So isn't there some benefit to some sort of bright line rule?
Yes, I think, though, that as the case law gets developed and as attorneys and everybody and more so lay people realize that this is a problem, that there's actually a conflict between the joint account statute and the power of attorney. This case is the first case. Nobody knew the parties here. The problem with fairness in this case is that the parties here didn't have any way of knowing that this was going to be a conflict. They thought that we're doing this power of attorney for another reason. Why would it affect a joint account? I didn't know I had a duty not to spend money that wasn't for my immediate benefit that later on benefits the family as a whole because I'm doing things for Johnny Russ while she's doing things for me.
With all due respect, I've seen great wills drafted by lawyers and then not ask the client how all the property is held. And the house is held in joint tenancy, all the bank accounts are joint tenancy, all the stocks are joint tenancy. The person dies, great will covers nothing because they've done testamentary planning ahead of time, and that's what the joint tenancy is. It's during life and afterwards. So I have another bright line rule that I'm going to propose. I think it's somewhat similar to what Justice Butler may have been talking about. You have a joint account at the date of the power of attorney. It's arguable that as to that money, the joint tenancy lives on. What you have after the power of attorney, you then have money coming in that's the mother's money. There is no question here, all this money belonged to the mother, right? Before it hit the account.
Yes.
Right? Okay. I suggest that the fiduciary, that is, the person with the power of attorney, as soon as he got the power of attorney, had an obligation to put all of mother's money in mother's sole account. And that putting it in a joint account, in effect, gave him half or more, or any amount from that account. And he can't do that. He has to put that in mother's name as a fiduciary. So once he became the fiduciary, he could not put money into his name with mother, whether it was payable on death or joint tenancy. And everything that came into the account after the power of attorney is mother's. If he wants money out of her account, he has to account for it, and he is entitled to reimbursement for, depending on their intent, room and board, clothing, normal gifts on appropriate occasions in appropriate amounts to the entire family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And as to the money before the power of attorney that was in that account, it's arguable, if you want bright line rules, he can do whatever he wants in that because he had no fiduciary relationship as to that. Mother said, it's yours if you want it, because that's what it means, joint tenancy. So you divide out between pre and post power of attorney, and it's self-dealing to put the mother's money to where he can get access, not as fiduciary, but access as a co-owner. What do you think of that? Yeah, and well, I think that's really what, maybe I'm wrong, but I, that's what I heard from Justice Butler.
To put that duty on the agent, when the principal is still competent, the principal could have done that herself. And she and in addition to that, she required no accounting in the power of attorney. So I don't think that the fiduciary should have realized that joint account was supposed to be, the money was supposed to be segregated that way.
You can. So I don't think that should be a bright. I keep hearing you say that. So what I keep hearing you say is this is not a power of attorney case because the son never exercised the power of attorney. Therefore, just treat it as a joint tenancy case. I keep hearing you say that. And if that's true, and that it's not a power of attorney because it's just sitting out in limbo and never used, that's a different fact situation than the one I think we're dealing with.
Well, the way I look at it, the appellant is asking for the fact that the power of attorney document itself is the only contrary evidence that can apply to 70503. And they're saying as a matter of law, if a power of attorney is signed, then that's contrary intent, the joint account statute doesn't apply anymore. I think that the trial court actually found that there was no conversion, that Elliot Russ didn't breach his fiduciary duty. His fiduciary duty under all the circumstances was to take care of his mother. And if you can't find that, if you can't find that the power of attorney as a matter of law is all the intent that can be under 70503, then I think the trial court's ruling that there's no breach of fiduciary duty and no conversion in this case should stand. And I don't think any of the trial court's findings of fact have been challenged in this case, and I don't think there is evidence. There's constructed evidence after the fact because none of the parties saw that they would need an accounting of what the expenses actually were, and that was admitted at trial.
Chief, if I may, I want to give you one last shot, because what I heard the chief just say, what about this is a bright line rule, and you not really go along with it, was, in my mind, exactly what you argued on page 20 of your brief. You said, possibly the only bright line rule, extensions thereof or warnings thereof, that should come out of this case is that no joint account can be used for self-dealing if opened after the power of attorney by the agent. Now, I admit that it's not exactly on all fours with what the chief said.
I had a self-dealing. Yeah.
Did I say after or before?
You said after.
So the twist in the fact situation I gave you is that the joint tenancy is opened after the POA, mm-hmm. and that would be, in your mind, not lawful. And I'm saying, in effect, putting money into a pre-existing joint tenancy, is opening up a joint tenancy after.
Well,
so my last question to you, and then I hear Justice Crooks, God bless him.
Just a minute.
I hear Justice Crooks ask you, well, you want like the Illinois approach, and you you said, well, you don't know if you could, and then he tried again, and are you trying, the Illinois approach, and he said, well, I'm not asking because there's special stuff in Illinois about convenience accounts and competing presumptions, and then he tried again. So the final time, what are you asking?
Of course I like the Illinois approach
What do you want us to write?
It's not my province to think that way, but I'm thinking of judicial economy also. And the Illinois approach, there are a few problems with judicial economy, and it will create a lot of cases. But I think this case especially, it has to be done something similar to the Illinois case, because the parties were not aware of what they were getting into in this case of a possible conflict between the statutes. I think in the future, unfortunately, if there are a lot of cases, the case law is going to become developed. It's going to filter down to the public that there is a problem with when a joint account and a power of attorney exist together, and we better make really sure that we be very careful and get attorney's advice and make sure it's done the right way. And it could be very simple. That advice could be just close a joint account and open up a joint account afterwards, and then you know that the fiduciary can't, since he's putting the money into the account, he can't withdraw the account because he does have a fiduciary duty then.
No.
I ask when...
Justice Prosser.
The court originally gave a summary judgment to your opposing counsel, isn't that right?
Yes, I wasn't in the case at that time, but that's correct.
Okay. How do you account that summary judgment was granted and then, in effect, completely nullified?
Well, the judge changed, after hearing all the facts, the judge changed his summary judgment decision.
I take it on summary judgment that the judge didn't hear any testimony.
Correct. That I know of.
Were there significant affidavits?
Well, I think that yes, there were affidavits. I think it was on affidavits. But the thing is that the judge actually didn't make another summary judgment decision. He modified his original summary judgment decision to comply with what his decision actually, his decision in the entire case was based on the facts. So he amended it or vacated that part of the summary judgment proceeding decision that was in conflict with his actual decision.
Well, he was trying to do equity here. The judge clearly was trying. This is a very difficult case. It's one that has, as Justice Bradley says, enormous implications, and he was trying to fit this case into what he thought the statute said, and that's, again, the intent. And so, to me, I think the suggestions of the bench here have been good ones. The difficulty is that we won't be able to rewrite the power of attorney, but I think it's a recognition of the problems. Justice Crooks is, and I would say that some modification of the Illinois rule sounds reasonable, but what doesn't sound reasonable to me is that if we create a bright line and that's it, because I think that that has some unfairness here, because people are doing this themselves, and I gather that that's what happened here. But both counsel, I think, have pretty much agreed on that, and I see the dangers in allowing self-dealing. So
I agree with that, yeah. Your Honor, Justice. I think that possibly in the future, though, after a number of these cases have passed through a number of courts in the country, I think, and after more information is out about the dangers, possibly a bright line rule in the future is possible, but not before people realize what they're getting into. I think that's where the fairness and equity comes in.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Buxton. Mr. Meyer?
Thank you. The French have an expression, l'esprit d'escalier, and if you will pardon my bad accent, it translates literally as the spirit of the staircase. Spirit of the staircase. It is when you walk down the staircase having been to a meeting somewhere and you think, darn, I wish I'd said that. Well, rebuttal is sort of that. And while I cannot digest the statute entirely in the marital property situation, and I don't know enough about marital property law to render an opinion to Justice Abramson's suggestion, I do enough law with power of attorneys, and I am able to offer a suggestion to Justice Rogensack. The solution is put your intent in the power of attorney document. If you do intend all of your money to belong to your husband and to be used for self-dealing by your husband in joint bank accounts. Put it in the document.
Perhaps, Mr. Meyer, it's in the document. Let me posit a possible way of looking at this case, and you tell me where I go wrong. All right, unless you think I'm right. You have a situation where clearly a fiduciary duty is created by the power of attorney. You have, as one of the fiduciary responsibilities, the banking responsibility. We went through that before. But you also have in the power of attorney the statement, third sentence, by signing this document, you are not giving up any rights to control your finances and property yourself. As I understand the facts in this case, on October 10th, 2002, Johnny Russ was declared incompetent.
That was the adjudication, yes.
All right. Up until that point in time, my understanding is that she was competent. And if she is competent up until that adjudication of incompetence, the duty that Mr. Elliot Russ would have to protect her money, to perhaps set up a separate account, if you view it in that fashion, that's kind of what I was getting at before. Does that kick in at exactly at the time that he signs the document, or does that kick in at the point of incompetency? Because otherwise, she still has the power to control her own money. And so when I look at this contract, this document, this power of attorney, that preserves in her the ability to make decisions about how to spend her money, can a fiduciary responsibility override her wishes?
Where you went wrong in that reasoning process, Your Honor, is in the suggestion that the declaration of incompetence is somehow a determinative fact. It isn't. This is a durable power of attorney intended to become effective on signing. And that's the last page of the document.
I understand that. I understand. Right.
Having signed it, Johnny Russ did in fact maintain the power, to the legal theoretical power up until the adjudication, to do things that she was still able to do. She didn't lose the power by giving it to...
Let me phrase the question a different way. At the time she signed this document, she was obviously competent to sign this document, to put this power of attorney. Otherwise, Elliot wouldn't have a power of attorney. All right. So at the time she signed the document, she's competent to make decisions about her money. According to the document, she retains the power to make decisions about her money. So in the absence of evidence to the contrary, that she has somehow changed her point of view, my question is, does the fiduciary have an independent duty to perhaps, and that's a question of fact, and that goes back to Justice Rogenstein's earlier questions, does the fiduciary have an independent duty to perhaps override the principal's decision-making about how the money should be handled and whether or not it should go into this joint account?
What the fiduciary acquires is a duty not to self-deal. And that duty applies whether the principal has been adjudicated or incompetent or is functionally incompetent. The trust that is placed in the fiduciary triggers the duty. That's the duty. And it doesn't make any difference whether the fiduciary has the principal has the legal power to go back and undo it. And here's the solution. If there's any question, if the fiduciary says, gosh, Mom, I'm not sure that I can do that, Mom puts it in the document. It is the answer for the question of whether or not this question should be addressed. And it is the position, my bright line position is the intent of the parties when they change the legal relationship should come out of the document. It is significant, I think, that all of the provisions on page 2 of the power of attorney are not initialed. The ability to say Elliot is entitled to compensation is not initialed. The ability to say the power to gift is conferred is not initial. There are the place in paragraph 16 where she could have said, all my money is Elliot's.
So what he's been doing for the past 8 years is all of a sudden stopped. In other words, now she expects him to take care of mom, not and do it on $3,000 a year or four or five or six. I mean, that's...
It requires a new duty, Your Honor, and he has questions.
And that's the legal answer, and we want to give an answer. But what I'm saying here is that unless you look at the intent, unless we're going to just say from now on this is it, and I think that's a very, very harsh rule that flies in the face of common sense as how things are handled around the state of Wisconsin and in other states. So that's what you're running up against.
Your Honor, the villains who steal money from violent from vulnerable citizens.
I understand about the villains. We're not talking. If you can point out in this case that there are villains in this case, you tell me.
They don't all have handlebar mustaches and go by the name Snidely Whiplash. They look like our brothers and sisters.
Of course.
They also look like our brothers and sisters. And that's the problem. Because when you get into a fact, case-by-case determination, you are opening up so much to uncertainty.
And we understand that, counsel. I you've got my ear on that, and I understand that. So I'm not disagreeing. But we also know that when you go into a nursing home, you're talking about $65,000 a year, and these people were doing it on a tenth of that.
And competent principals can address those situations in layman's language in the standard form. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer, and thank you, Mr. Buxton, for your arguments today on what several of the justices have labeled one of the most important cases to come to the court because of its effect on many, many people in the state. That closes our hearing on 05-AP-2492, Johnny Russ versus Elliot Russ. The court will take a few minutes of recess so that the students who are leaving may leave and additional students may come into the courtroom. We are in recess for a few moments.
Tina, this is still on. You want me to try this?